the value of the object, as Clausewitz says, is extremely high for Putin. Whereas you look at the Ukrainian object, this is a matter of life and death. It's survival. Clausewitz basically says if what you're doing militarily is not affecting their will to fight or their ability to fight, you need to start questioning what you're doing. The war goes on basically until someone refuses to pay anymore. They get to the point where they're not going to pay anymore in blood or pay anymore in treasure. And he said at that point, peace breaks out.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the very generous support of the West Point Class of 1974. I'm John Amble, editorial director at MWI, and I'm joined on this episode by Dr. Donald Stoker. He is a historian, a professor at the National Defense University's Eisenhower School, and the author of a number of books, including a biography of the Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz. Clausewitz's ideas are held in exceptionally high regard among U.S. military scholars, but it can be a challenge to unpack them with precision and nuance and apply them to real-world security challenges. But Don joins me on this episode to do just that, specifically taking Clausewitz's ideas about war and peace and using them to understand the war in Ukraine and how it might eventually come to an end. It was fascinating for me to hear his thoughts on the subject, and I think listeners will also really enjoy hearing them. Before we get to the discussion, a couple notes. First, I want to say thank you to the West Point Class of 1974 for their very generous support to MWI. Second, be sure to subscribe to the MWI podcast on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And finally, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, the National Defense University, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Dr. Donald Stoker. Don, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to it.
So I asked you to come on the podcast to talk about an article that you recently published that you co-authored with Michael Campbell called Clausewitz Theory and Ending the Ukraine War. It was in Military Strategy magazine. And I found it really, really compelling reading for a lot of different reasons. And we're going to talk about some of those. But if we can kind of kick off the conversation, I want to ask you, you know, this was in an issue of the magazine that was applying the ideas of various theorists to the Ukraine war and to war in the 21st century. Did you start thinking about this because you were invited to write about it? Or was Clausewitz sort of an anchor point for you as you've been thinking about the war in Ukraine for the past 2+ years?
I got invited to write it at the very last minute because someone else was supposed to write the article. And I know the editor and this other person got ill. I don't even know who it was, but they got ill and just simply couldn't do it. And so A. Stahl, the editor, he sent me this frantic email, please, Don, will you bail us out here? And what was funny is I was actually on vacation in Europe at the time. I was in Austria. And I'm like, I don't know. I have to think about it a little bit. And so I said, well, there's no way I can do this from here by myself, even though I have my computer. And so one of my colleagues, Mike Campbell, has spent a lot of time studying the Ukraine war. And so I emailed him and we went back and forth. I said, hey, here's what we're going to do. Because I had written, I wrote a book, Why America Loses Wars, a number of years ago. And to me, the best chapter and the most interesting chapter in the book is the chapter on the difficulties with ending a war, particularly a war fought for a limited aim where no one is prostrate, particularly on either side. And so our conversations back and forth between Mike was like, look, we'll take the basic ideas from this chapter. We'll take your knowledge of the Ukraine war and we'll meld this together and let's see what we come up with. And that was the basic concept of the article, because I use a lot of Clausewitz's ideas in that chapter and then I add some more. But also, and I regret not putting this in a footnote, the 3 points about, you know, what is being sought politically, how far you should go militarily, and who's going to maintain the peace and why. This was actually a model for discussing these ideas that was developed by Brad Lee at the Naval War College. He used to be a professor in the strategy department and has retired a number of years ago now. But this was something that he developed. Like, look, how do we think about these things? And it was such a good idea. I stole it whole cloth. So in the book, I have the citation saying where I stole it from, but basically then took, okay, Brad's ideas, Clausewitz's ideas, and then some other ideas from Machiavelli and other places, and just kind of mix it all into the blender, seeing, okay, here's the situation. How do we look at it? Because that's something that I always struggle with and is always very important to me, particularly when teaching, trying to define the terms and trying to see, what are we really looking at here? How can we get at the guts of what's really going on? How do we sort through this just amazingly complex, subject? And when you look at the strategic studies literature and the related political science literature as well, one of the weakest parts of it is the literature on how to end wars. It's just not very well constructed. There's a lot of good stuff out there, but there's no like systematic effort that combines it all together that presents something that's well functionally usable in class. And I think Brad kind of solved that problem, at least a big piece of it, and with introducing the theory of it. I think it gives us a really nice, I've done this a lot of times in class. Okay, here are these 3 points. Think about how to end this war, which is the most complex thing you're going to do, and which is often harder and more difficult than the actual waging of the war itself.
Yeah, the sort of tripartite framework of these 3 questions, right, that you mentioned, is kind of provides the structure of the article. And we're going to take those questions in turn, yeah, because I think it's a really useful sort of sequential way of thinking through this. Before we do, I think probably all, or at least the vast majority of our listeners, will be quite familiar with Clausewitz, the military theorist. He is, one among many military theorists that people like you kind of point to and use to structure their thinking, yeah, about real world problems. But in the U.S. military, and I would say particularly in the U.S. Army, he is kind of, put on a pedestal and at a minimum, first among equals. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Clausewitzian theory, that Karl von Clausewitz's ideas, provide a particularly valuable or even the best framework for thinking through real world challenges like ending the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, I do. I mean, his theory actually is a little lacking on ending the war, like everyone else, but he says more about it. He never really structured something for doing that, but I haven't found anyone else either that has. So, taking various ideas from different places ends up being, I think the best way to do it. But his ideas, I wrote a biography of Clausewitz, and I think it came out about 10 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago now, for Oxford. And one of the things, there's a lot of cliches about Clausewitz, he's some staff officer just sitting in a cube in the Pentagon, but the, Napoleonic version of that, which is completely not the case. He did do some of that, and he was a staff officer, but he was also a combat infantry officer, was in at least 3 dozen battles, was once wounded in battle, took a bayonet to the head, which is, that means you're actually involved if you're taking a bayonet to the side of the head. So he also brings to his work and to his theory this extensive military experience in combat. And he was at the Battle of Borodino, the bloodiest one-day battle in the 19th century, so he brings that with him to this like deep knowledge and deep study of military history and military theory. And to him, the ideas have to be practical. They have to actually function in the real world, which is one of the things that qualifies theory. Now, that doesn't mean everything he says is right. That doesn't mean there aren't contradictions in the text. All these things are true. There's a lot of things you can criticize him for. But when you read the other theorists and read his ideas, particularly his ideas are just frankly usually superior, I think. Of course, I wrote a biography of it, so I'm prejudiced. But particularly the thing that is so overlooked, I think, and one of the things we talk about in the article, and it fits, right into with your discussion with Brad's idea. You're thinking about the political aim. You're thinking about the object of what you're at war for, and how important this is, and how much this underpins the actions of the powers. The 3-point thing that Brad comes up with is very much based on Clausewitz here. What do you want politically? And you see a lot of things written about the Ukraine war and the problems of ending it and the challenges of ending it. But most of them ignore the very, very basic factor of what each side wants, and then the critical factor of how serious this is in their mind. One of the great things about having Mike help me with this article, he was very familiar with Putin's discussions and the literature that Putin the Putin speeches and so on, and everything he says about why Ukraine is so critical in his view to Russia's survival, this just immediately raises the difficulty of how you're going to end this thing. Because the value of the object, as Clausewitz says, is extremely high for Putin. Whereas you look at the Ukrainian object, this is a matter of life and death. It's survival, which means the value of the object is very, very high as well. When this happens historically, when you have two countries that both the object is very high, if one's not capable of overpowering the other in a very short amount of time, it gets bloody and nasty and goes on for a long time.
Well, you know, and this is one of those areas where there's always a risk of sort of blurring a discussion, a strategic discussion, into the kind of operational level of war.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we think about those, if we think from a strategic level, we talk in terms of ends, ways, and means, right? And which is not a Clausewitzian lexicon. That's, I guess, Arthur Leike's nomenclature that he introduced in the 80s. But we're talking about the ends here, right? When this first question, what is being sought politically, is fundamentally the strategic political ends. You talked a little bit about how important the objectives of both Russia and Ukraine are, but are they also fluid? Can they change over the course of time? You know, when Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, had a particular objective in mind. How much has that shifted, or has it not at all?
From what I can tell, it hasn't changed at all. I mean, he sought the destruction of the Ukraine regime, and he might say a few things here from time to time. There's no indication that he's given that up that I have seen that's credible. You see rumors saying, he recently made a peace offer, but the peace offer was essentially one the Ukrainians could never deal with. And it was essentially, you know, how serious was Putin about it? Well, he obviously wasn't, because he knew that the Ukrainians would never accept it. To me, it looked like he was making a peace offer to try to discredit the Ukrainians with it, because he knew they were going to not accept it. But so he's not serious about it. And the difficulty you have here is, okay, for both sides, how do you make both of them serious about making peace, one or the other? And that's going to take something very bloody and significant to happen, probably, or Putin dying or something like that, I think. So it's part of the complexity of this. There's just so many moving parts with it.
And if we look at that first question, what is being sought politically from a Ukrainian perspective? You know, I think if we transport ourselves sort of cognitively back to February of 2022, you know, I think initially it was just survival from one day to the next.
Oh, yeah.
How much has a sort of political objective crystallized and become more detailed in from the perspective of Kyiv in terms of what they want the outcome of this war to be?
Zelensky, from what I've seen, has been pretty consistent on what he expects the war to deliver as aims, you know, not the preservation of Ukraine, certainly, but also the restoration of their 2014 borders. Now, is there a possibility he could bend on that? Yeah. I mean, the aims can change based upon what happens and how badly someone's losing or how well they're winning. But he, from publicly what I've seen, I haven't seen anything where he's backed off on that at all. So you have two countries that their aims are irreconcilable currently. What will it take to make one of them change?
And what could it take?
Putin dying, the collapse of the Russian army like it did in 1917, the Western countries stop supporting Ukraine, so it collapses because it doesn't have enough external support. All of those things are certainly potential things, but getting either one of those to happen is exceedingly difficult. And, you know, will either one of them happen in the short term is very unlikely, I think. You know, so, and if Putin dies, which some people speculate all the time about Putin being ill, which no one's ever presented any evidence about that either. But then if he dies, what do you get after?
Right.
We don't know that. Maybe you get a different version of Putin and the war continues. So maybe even that's not a solution.
Well, if these sort of political ends, these political objectives can't be reconciled, right? Crimea is in the Donbass, and, you know, whether or not a regime in Kyiv that has proven to be defiant of Moscow's wishes for a number of years, you know, these are things that neither side seems willing to give on, which leads us to the next question, though, because even if you aren't willing to give in on them, there still is this question of, as you said, how far must or should one go militarily to achieve this? How does that question play out from a Russian perspective versus a Ukrainian perspective?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think of the options here, and you go back to the aim. The article has this whole laundry list of things that Clausewitz suggests upon what to do about taking their territory, defeating their forces, fighting defensively, something politically happening that causes a change. But the difficulty with doing any of these and having any of these things happen is something that both sides really face. I mean, the Russians, to get what they want, they have to destroy the Ukrainian will, which means their military would then collapse, or destroy their means, which means destroying their military forces, which means then they wouldn't be able to defend themselves. And they've proven so far unable to do that. Now, that doesn't mean they won't prove able to do that in the future. Perhaps something would change. But the Russian army seems to be slow learning, to say the least here. And do they have the capability to do these two things? Or one of these two things, Clausewitz basically says, if what you're doing militarily is not affecting their will to fight or their ability to fight, you need to start questioning what you're doing, because those are the two things you need to do. And the Russians, they have been grinding down the Ukrainian ability to fight, because the Ukrainians just simply lack the equipment and they lack the manpower that they need to do it. But then, okay, how long are they able to do this? There are some, I don't know if these are accurate assessments, but there's some assessments of the Russians that would say that within 2 years, they're not going to be able to do this anymore. Okay, that's an easy thing to say. There are too many other factors feeding into that could change that one way or the other. But now when you think about the Ukrainians, their problem is they have to convince the Russians to stop fighting. How do you do that? The only way, I think, again, the same thing, they've got to either break their will to fight or their means to fight. And they came close to, you could argue, roughly a year ago, trying to break the means when they threw the Russian army back. But if you think if they had had more means to do that, if they had mobilized their manpower earlier, and really, lowered the conscription age to like 18 or something, like most countries would have done, and raised a larger army, would they have been able to inflict a decisive or at least a more brutal defeat on the Russians, one enough that was enough to make them quit? I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of what ifs on all of these things, a series of what ifs. But the difficulty the Ukrainians have, that as long as Putin's in power, how is this thing going to end? I don't see it ending as long as Putin is in power. Unless he could change his mind tomorrow, but he seems to be pretty determined and pretty set on on the importance, on the value of the object of taking Ukraine.
I don't know whether Vladimir Putin has read Clausewitz or whether or not he thinks about this war in a Clausewitzian framework, but do you think he does? I mean, do you think he's thinking in terms of, we need our war effort to be able to either crush the will of the Ukrainian people and the military to resist, or eliminate their ability to do so?
I don't know. I mean, I have no idea about his training or education on that. I mean, in the Soviet system, the idea that a lot of the Clausewitzian ideas were very much ingrained in their military thinking, but I don't know if these are specific ones. I mean, they very much believed in, the political aim and the political object of it was a critical motivator for them as well. And they understood that, Lenin was very much steeped in Clausewitzian thought, and a lot of that went into their military system, but I don't know if it applies to Putin or not. I mean, certainly the value of the object applies to him, even though he might not know the specific term, because he does very much value, if we believe enough from what he says, in his view, if Russia doesn't possess the Ukraine, Russia cannot be a great power. And there are other people that write about Russian history and stuff, and this is not an unusual trend with some of the writers, unusual statement where this is often said, as well. Is it true? I don't know or not, but it's an argument that you often see that's worth considering. Certainly, it seems to be that Putin thinks this is true.
Do you think Ukraine's will or ability to continue the war is more vulnerable? Because, you know, when we watched the early part of the war, the stories were all about this collective resolve on the part of Ukrainians to resist, to defend, right? And because the narrative has sort of framed Ukraine's fight as one of national survival, you think, well, if it's one of survival, you will fight till the last, to the last, you know, hryvnia or the last drop of Ukrainian blood. Yeah. But Ukrainian survival doesn't, I mean, that can take a lot of forms, right? It could take a form of a Ukrainian survival with the regime intact, but no Crimea and no Donbass or only part of the Donbass. Or it could, you know, it's more complicated than that. Do you think it is it the will or the ability to continue the fight that is their greatest vulnerability?
Ooh, that's a hard one. That's a tough one. I remember in the buildup for the war, and then right after when the war kicked off, I have a friend who for the last 30 years, he's worked in Eastern and Central Europe, basically doing various defense stuff and planning and resourcing and so on. A lot of experience working in the Ukraine and other places. And one of the things that he noticed after, working in Ukraine in 2013 and earlier, and then working afterward in 2014 after Crimea and the Donbass, he said that for him, he said it was a noticeable shift in his view in Ukrainian nationalism, in this national feeling and Ukrainian patriotism, and then essentially a strength, what Klauser would call arguably a strengthening of the will. And you pointed out that you saw this as well when the war escalated in 2022. It was the amazing stories you read about, you know, people basically forming their own military units and taking the field without the government even being involved in even the slightest way, veterans from the 2014 group or war that had kept in contact, and suddenly they were in civilian life and they just put their unit back together with no encouragement or instruction from anyone. It's just stunning to see that. So what will last longer, the will or the means, I think a lot of that depends on what happens. Ukrainians have proved to be pretty serious about this, pretty serious about it. Not to say that everyone is supportive and they've had a lot of people avoid conscription and so on. But the means issue seems to have been more difficult. I mean, if it wasn't for Western aid, would Ukraine have survived this long? I think they probably would have, but they would have lost a lot more territory because the Russians just haven't done a very good job. And the Ukrainians keep seeming ability to keep cobbling things together and improvising and innovating and going on. But I mean, the means issue without Western support will break down more, which leads me, I mean, it's kind of straying off the point, but something I see on one frame of the writing on this Ukraine war, you see people calling Ukraine an American proxy and see people saying, oh, this is a proxy war between America and Ukraine. And you see this confusion in a lot of American commentators or some American commentators about, oh, America's war in Ukraine. And it's kind of important to point out here that Ukraine would be fighting this war regardless of what the United States did. It's not a proxy. Ukraine acts in its own interest. We just give them stuff. You know, so they are not our proxy. So it's very much here's why understanding Klaus's political aim and the motivations is so important. This is easy how you tell if someone's doing it for their own, you know, on their own and not someone else driving them, then they're not a proxy. So even though you're giving them stuff, you know, so I find that a little that we are not at war in Ukraine. You know, we are giving them stuff and we're supporting them, but the United States is not fighting a war in Ukraine. So that's very, you see, oh, this is another forever war for the United States. We're not fighting this war. And I think it's a very important thing to point out here, because some of the writing that I see on it, particularly on websites, is just so confused about what the actual reality of the situation is. Part of the American problem, particularly in big chunks of the defense community, without understanding political motivations and not understanding whether you're at war or not. It's just part of the whole structure of strategic studies that we have failed to build properly. You know, so,
well, you know, for people, say Americans or Western commentators who view this as a U.S. war or a NATO war, you know, they have that in common then with Vladimir Putin, because he sees this right as a defensive war against Western U.S.-led Western aggression.
He says that. You know, so, but he says lots of things. You know, he says he's going to nuke us next week. Will he? Well, he might. Who knows? But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, people say lots of things. You know, it's a way for him to spin up the Russian people, you know, certainly. So how much they actually believe that, I don't know.
And I think that's an important point because, you know, for years, you know, if you looked at Russia, just if you just looked at the data, Russia was a country with an aging population, crumbling infrastructure, an economy overwhelmingly dependent on hydrocarbons, and a volatile hydrocarbon market. And so, you know, that was a good way of understanding some of Putin's bellicosity, was because he had to give everyday Russians outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg an explanation for why they're suffering and their lives are not very pleasant oftentimes. And that's, you know, I was in Kyiv. I guess this is sort of back to kind of national resolve and a will to fight. I was in Kyiv a handful of times in the few years before the invasion. I was last there in August and September 2021 on the 30th anniversary of Ukraine's independence. And I got a chance to go to the parade.
Oh, that's amazing.
And the I don't know that I've ever seen a sentiment that strong. That, you know, the pro-Ukrainian sentiment of the Ukrainians that were there, and granted, you know, it's a self-selected population of people who decide to come to the parade, and yet still, you know, the Antonov cargo aircraft, the largest aircraft ever built, which was destroyed at Hostomel Airport in the first week of the invasion, flew over, and I've never heard a roar that drowned out these jet engines because the crowd was, and I thought, at the beginning of the war, I thought about that experience, and then I thought about Russians and having to communicate them that, you know, this sacrifice of thousands and thousands of Russian soldiers that are going to be killed for this, it's going to be a lot more difficult to maintain that will to continue the fight on the part of Russia than it is on Ukraine. And yet we've seen Russia somehow continue to do that. So it's a really sort of opaque sort of thing to measure and wrap your head around, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, this is why this is not a math equation. You know, trying to do the assessment of, you know, Clausewitz talks about the difficulty of trying to understand your opponent. You know, he says Newton himself would quail under the weight of the equation. So, because this whole idea of will, nationalism, you know, how much depths of material can you actually pull out of the system? How long can the system function? The things that what you talked about with Russia, what were the problems you identified? The poor infrastructure, the aging population, dependent on hydrocarbons.
Exactly,
you know? None of this has changed. I mean, it's still exactly the same as what you said. But they still have the ability to continue to produce troops, continue to produce military equipment. They had huge stocks of old equipment they just started drawing on, which was, you know, it's fascinating to me, you know, having on a side interest of an interest in old military equipment and just seeing what has appeared, you know, in Ukraine. And the Russians have been willing and able to just draw on this, and they do have enough of a population to where they're continuously able to bring people in. So this is definitely huge. These are huge advantages that they have over the Ukrainians, huge advantages.
Yeah, I think a willingness to, you know, sort of force conscription on a population that doesn't necessarily want it at times, a willingness to, you know, or an ability to reach an agreement with Iran to locally produce Shahed drones, you know, to cozy up to North Korea and its, with its massive stocks of rocket artillery and things of that nature. Are
all the 152 millimeter rounds they've been storing up since the 50s.
Exactly. So I want to shift then to the third question that you mentioned in the piece, which is how or who will maintain the peace settlement and how. So if we kind of get back or get beyond the cognitive barrier of figuring out how we can get enough interest alignment with the political objectives, what each side is seeking, to imagine a place where there's negotiations for some sort of peace treaty or some sort of settlement, why does it matter who will maintain the peace settlement and how?
There are actually a couple of really interesting things that people have written over the years about just the difficulty of this once you actually get the settlement. And when you think about the partners, the characters involved in this, nations involved in this, where you've got the Ukrainians on one side and the Russians on the other, if you're the Ukrainians, do you trust any agreement that Vladimir Putin has signed? The obvious answer is no. You know, so you've got that going in. And so there was some type of negotiated settlement that was made, the Russians under Putin, I cannot see them keeping it. And I think they will do everything possible to undermine it. They will constantly attack not even physically attack, but constantly do things with propaganda and information and cyber and everything as well to undermine the Ukrainian system or whatever Ukrainian government exists then afterward. You know, they will do everything they can to undermine it until Putin decides, okay, now I'm in a position where I can try this again. You know, so that's the problem, I think, with an agreement. So you would have to, any kind of agreement that you could get, if you got one, you're right to ignore the problems and then just assume we have it is the best way to think about this for a second. But what it would require for the West to do to prop up Ukraine for the long period of time that this might take afterward is a whole host of questions. Do you put peacekeeping troops in? Well, Putin's not going to agree to that because he would probably have to be NATO troops. So he's not going to agree to that, certainly. Especially, you know, you mentioned all the rhetoric that he's had about, oh, this is a NATO war. Well, obviously, he's not going to allow NATO troops to go there. You know, so who's going to enforce the peace? How do you make the Russians agree to anything that they have? You could make the Ukrainians probably would agree, I would think, and the West would have some leverage over them because of finances and providing them with continued military support in order to get them to agree. But making the Russians agree, making Putin agree, good luck with that one. Yeah. So I'd hate to be the poor guy in the room that has to sort that one out. You know, so that would be like the worst job that anyone had been handed in a very, very, very long time.
You know, if you think back to like September 1945 and the aboard the USS Missouri, right, and the Japanese formal surrender, that, you know, that sort of image looks a lot more like how wars ended in the time of Clausewitz than maybe what we've become accustomed to over recent decades. Is it reasonable to argue, look, there's no way that Ukraine and Russia signed a treaty and end this war?
That's not a crazy thing to say. And Putin's not interested in a treaty. He's interested in destruction of Ukraine, which then requires no treaty. He just takes it. But it would require him changing his aim in order for there to be a negotiated settlement. And then it would require the Ukrainians bending as well, because Putin's not going to give up what he's taken since 2014. But what does it take to get both of these powers to agree to change their aims? Clausewitz says the war goes on basically until someone refuses to pay anymore. They get to the point where they're not going to pay any more in blood or pay any more in treasure. And he said at that point, peace breaks out. Somebody will make a deal. The difficulty is how do you get one or both of these countries to get to that point, which is what it's probably going to take, whether one or the other is too exhausted to continue it. But if the Ukrainians are the ones that are too exhausted, the war is not going to end well, because Russia, why would I stop if you're exhausted and pleading for peace? This means I'm winning. So unless there's some strange event that where they decide they need to take what they want, take what they can get because they have other concerns. But that's rare. I mean, when you look at how various endings of the Second World War, the Finns are able to get a deal out of the Russians where they get to survive. They lose a lot of stuff. They basically take a deal forced on them, but they keep their independence, at least mostly. Why? Why does Stalin agree to that? Stalin's got bigger fish to fry. It's just the Finns. So he's willing to, okay, here's what I want from you, Finland. Give me this and we're done. And the Finns take it. So it's not the best deal for them, but it's better than having a Soviet occupation.
Putin is no stranger to nuclear saber rattling. We've heard it over the past couple of years, a threat to use tactical nuclear weapons, which obviously did not exist in the time of Clausewitz. How does that factor into, particularly, you know, that second question of how far must or should one go militarily to include the use of tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield to achieve the desired political ends?
Yeah, that's... is Putin serious about their use is a question. And I don't know enough about his motivations or understanding of such things to say that. no if, but other people that have written about this that I think understand him better than I do, one of the things I've heard speculated is the Russians, this is a good question that you've asked, because one of the things I've heard people speculate is that if the Russians start losing the war, and it looks like they might lose even the gains of 2014, or that Putin's regime becomes endangered, that this is a possibility that he might use them then under those circumstances. Is that true? I don't know. But there are some people that have written on that, and they're not crazy in their thinking. What little of it I've read, it's not so. But then, of course, that opens up a whole other idea. What happens if someone uses, if the Russians use a couple of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine? Well, you've got the practical reasons, practical problems. I mean, back during the Cold War, there are a lot of studies and obviously a lot of planning on how to use these weapons tactically. And a lot of times, like particularly in Korea, for example, the studies they did for that decided it wasn't worth it. You're not going to get much out of it. Is it the same today? I don't know. You know, would it work? Excuse me. Would it work in Ukraine, or as far as what would the effects be in Ukraine? I don't know. Don't know that either. And frankly, I don't want to find out, because it's something that scares the daylights out of me. Because once you start popping those things off, what happens next? Everybody, you know, maybe people react rationally, but maybe they lose their minds because they're scared to death afterward. What happens? Where do you go next with this? That's why it's so frightening, because no one knows. You know, a lot of the doctrine evolved, but Soviet thinking for a lot of the Cold War, again, this evolves, but for big chunks of the Cold War, was if you use one of these things, all bets are off. Everything goes. So who knows what the reactions will be? I don't think you would get that from one or two, but what do I know? Nothing. Yeah, you know, we're completely unknown territory where everybody is speculating at that point.
And I think it's important to understand that there is a, just as the U.S. had plans for the use of tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield during the Cold War, yeah. So did the Soviet Union. Russia still does. In its military doctrine, there is a place for tactical nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the binary distinction between nuclear weapons and conventional weapons that has emerged in the United States, for instance. Mm-hmm. Now, you said that, you know, the operative question is what comes next. But I think the interesting dynamic is that that also gets flipped around, because it becomes a question of signaling what comes next to Moscow, mm-hmm. in a way that dissuades them from making the decision to use it. The repercussions are going to be sufficiently high that you should feel discouraged from using these. And that's really the framework within which, you know, U.S. policy has been focused on this war, right? You know, there have been a lot of criticism about the pace of supplying different categories of weapons and different munitions. We saw with HIMARS and ATACMS, and, you know, that, hey, we're giving them too slow to make a difference on the battlefield. But that's all because of this desire, you know, trying to build a pattern of escalation management. And that gives the impression that you can sort of, almost like an orchestra conductor, you can kind of guide the conduct of a war and keep it from escalating too high or too rapidly. But ultimately, what we're talking about here, bringing a war to a close, is doing the reverse thing, right? Stopping that escalation and bringing it back down to a point where you can cease hostilities and obtain some sustainable political solution. Do you think that that's a useful way of looking at U.S. Is that how U.S. policymakers should look at this war? That, hey, we're trying to sort of usher it to a place where it can come to an end.
I think they're completely misreading the situation. Not that I know anything, but this. I'm not a big fan of the escalation theory, escalation ideas, because it usually ignores will and ignores the reactions of the opponent, and assumes that the opponent will act in certain ways when you don't actually control how the opponent can react, and you don't understand their mind. I mean, obviously you want to try to understand their mind as much as you possibly can, but it's very, very, very difficult to do that. So, I mean, I think this is Putin propaganda saying, you know, the pace of the weaponry and the pace of our supplying of the arms. I mean, you can see some of that being haphazard in the beginning, and understanding why, and understanding they're afraid of a bigger war, and understanding that there's a lot of doubt that the Ukrainians would even survive, so why give them anything? That's the most rational argument I've seen against why hesitating to do it. But to me, once the thing's fully committed, and once it's sure what's going on, you know, actually, once you started giving them stuff, why does a little matter more than, why does more matter than a little? I don't know. And then you end up where, who draws the line of saying it's too much? are you really just then making it easier for the opponent on the other side to do what they want because you've been bluffed by them? You know, I don't know. It's a very complex thing to say the least, but you can't calculate on the escalation from one side or the other. You just can't, because you don't know what people are going to do. You don't know what people are going to be considered too much, and you don't know if they actually take you seriously or not.
Well, I want to kind of, to wrap up, I want to ask, a question focused mainly on Ukraine, because I suspect that the vast majority of our listeners would generally like to see Ukraine prevail in this war. I would question why listeners who want Russia to win are probably listening to this podcast. But from a Ukrainian perspective, from your reading of Clausewitz, what would he advise? Here we sit in June 2024. What would he advise to Ukraine in terms of, you know, working through these three questions that we've talked about, and coming up with sort of a theory of victory that leads them to, you know, to an acceptable outcome in this war?
I think, boy, that's a tough one. I think if you were just looking at Clausewitz theory and trying to figure it out, okay, understanding the political aim of each side, you know, and how badly they want it, and then with how badly they want their aim, how much they want their aim, what the value of it is. But then looking at the Russians and say, okay, you know, Clausewitz has this idea of the center of gravity, which is essentially a way to do assessment at the strategic level. You know, where does their strength come from? What is critical? What is it, their leader? Is it their army? Is it the will of their people? You know, is their allies? Where does the strength come from? How do you then, when you figure this out, how do you then go about breaking it? So if you're thinking about, you know, what is so critical, what keeps Russia in this war? I mean, obviously their army is critical. If you can destroy their army, they'll quit, or they'll be forced to quit, or at least leave. You know, so, but that's an incredible weight to have to lift, right? I mean, destruction of the Russian army. The Russians did a pretty good job of that trying in the first year of the war, trying to do it on their own. And if the Ukrainians had developed their means more sufficiently, maybe they could have broken enough of it to where it made even a huge difference. But then you think about, okay, their leader is certainly key here in this. Okay, Putin. I mean, it's a coin toss, but if Putin disappears, goes away, whatever, no longer in the leadership position, it's a coin toss on whether the war continues. You know, it depends on what you get from it. But, okay, then maybe how do you make that happen? Also, very, very difficult. So the Ukrainians need to figure out a route for this. How do they do what they need to do? You planning for a long attritional war where they're doing the guys inflicting the attrition is something they probably, it looks like that's what they're doing now, you know, in a sense, you know, a defensive attrition strategy, which considering they're the inferior opponent in manpower. But if we keep arming them, they will be inferior in manpower, but superior technically, and superior in their killing power, which, you know, I never thought about this before, but your question makes me think about it as we talk about it. You know, you think about the Korean War. Later in the war, the Americans basically, the UN forces basically adopt a defensive attrition strategy. And you think, and well, gosh, why would you fight attritionally against the Chinese? Because they have a slight manpower advantage, to say the least. And they can continuously bring large amounts of manpower to bear on you, which is what the Russians have versus the Ukrainians. But we possessed a massively superior ability to kill the Chinese army in huge heaping numbers, because our men were so well equipped, we controlled the air, we had essentially unlimited artillery, all the infantry units were heavily armed, lots of automatic weapons, and they became experienced and well led, and it was just, they inflicted very, very large casualties on the Chinese very often later in the war because of that. You know, if the Ukrainians can get to that point and the Russians keep pushing them, then maybe that's something, that's a piece of it. But then the problem with that is there comes a point when you have to finish the job, when you have to go, either you make a deal like we did in Korea, or you go on the offensive and impose a deal. That's the harder part still, because it's going to be difficult for the Ukrainians to ever do that, I think. Not to say that it can't be done. You know, they proved that they could, under certain conditions, could mount a good offensive. If they get the F-16s, get control of the air, expand their army, we continue to equip them. Yeah, who knows? Yeah, so,
Well, then I want to thank you for joining me. I think we'll probably wrap up there. You know, I mentioned before we started recording that I've had several conversations with people about your article. And I think that that's because there's an appetite for, you know, as I said earlier, we sort of elevate Clausewitzian theory, Clausewitzian ideas, and to this sort of position of unquestioned supremacy within the U.S. Army, certainly.
I would agree with that.
But it is, you know, when we're talking about theory, it is that. It's theory. And so I think there's an appetite for a practical application of that theory in a way that helps us to understand real world problems, real world challenges and conflicts. And so I appreciate your article did that. I appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking about it a bit with me.
Thank you very much. And I'll plug my new book. I just wrote a history of American grand strategy that looks at American strategy from 1775 to today. It looks at virtually almost every war and all the administrations, and looks at how we used power, military, diplomatic, economic, informational power in these struggles. And we're using the aims as the foundation for the analysis.
Yeah, congratulations on the book. I'm looking forward to reading it. We might actually have to have you back on the podcast to talk about it, because it's a separate conversation, but an equally important and an interesting one. So Don, thank you again for joining me. Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing before you go. If you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.